We'll come to 1 Samuel and the 18th chapter. And you'll probably know this history, that chapter 17 is where David slays Goliath. And David is on the way up. Saul is on the way down. And it is that situation that we want to look at. And there are some parallels as we're going to look at Oliver Cromwell this evening, and we want to read this portion firstly. 1 Samuel 18, we'll begin our reading at verse 12. And Saul was afraid of David, because the Lord was with him, and was departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from him, and made him his captain over 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. And David behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Wherefore, when Saul saw that he behaved himself very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, because he went out and came in before them. And Saul said to David, Behold, my elder daughter Merib, her will I give thee to wife. Only be thou valiant for me, and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul said, Let not mine hand be upon him, but let the hand of the Philistines be upon him. And David said unto Saul, Who am I, and what is my life, or my father's family in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king? But it came to pass at the time when Merib, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given unto Adriel the Meholathite to wife. And Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. And Saul said, I will give him her, that she may be a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Wherefore Saul said to David, Thou shalt this day be my son-in-law in the one of the twain. And Saul commanded his servant, saying, Commune with David secretly, and say, Behold, the king hath delight in thee, and all his servants love thee. Now therefore be the king's son-in-law. And Saul's servants spake those words in the ears of David. And David said, Seemeth it to you a light thing to be a king's son-in-law, seeing that I am a poor man and lightly esteemed? And the servants of Saul told him, saying, On this manner spake David. And Saul said, Thus shall ye say to David, The king desireth not any dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines, to be avenged of the king's enemies. But Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. And when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law, and the days were not expired. Wherefore David arose and went, he and his men, and slew of the Philistines 200 men. And David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full teal to the king, that he might be the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, to wife. And Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. And Saul was yet the more afraid of David, and Saul became David's enemy continually. Then the princes of the Philistines went forth, and it came to pass after they went forth that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was much set by. You turn again to 1 Samuel 18. I'd like to draw your attention to three statements concerning David, which greatly worried King Saul. King Saul, as you know, failed the nation. He sinned against God, and it was God's will to remove him. And so we have in the Bible a precedent of God removing a king who had become a hindrance rather than a blessing. But three statements you will find in verse 12, first of all. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him. In verse 14, David behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. And then verse 28, and Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David. You can know that a man has made his mark in life when his enemies come along later, dig up his corpse, re-execute him, and hang his head in public view for all to scorn. You can be sure that such a one has not lived and died in obscurity. Oliver Cromwell's body was exhumed and posthumously executed in January 1661 under the reign of Charles II, the son of Charles I. Cromwell's headless trunk probably lies in an unmarked grave in the Tyburn area, which was the execution area in the city of Westminster, London. His head, for a long while, hung in public view in the Westminster Tyburn area, and it was held there as a vindication of the Stuart marks of the execution of Charles I. Today that head has been bequeathed to his former Cambridge College in Sussex. And in 1990, that skull was what they call immured in the antechapel there. I say this tonight because it has to be true that Oliver Cromwell, of all men, is the man that saw the greatest change in the history of Great Britain, more than any other man. He was the man for the hour and for the cause. He earned the title of dictator and of cruel tyrant, who could not control his fury against his opponents. He has been accused of mass slaughter in Ireland in a campaign to crush a rebellion against the Parliament. And of course, he is the man that is most often associated with the unique, the only case in history of the decapitation of an English king, Charles I. However, if you visit the city of London today, as Beulah and the boys and I did last summer, not this summer, summer of 2005, Oliver Cromwell's statue still stands at the entrance to Westminster Parliament. And all who know something of history walking by must recognize the stature of this man in English history and in English parliamentary proceedings. We would have to say that the period in which he reigned was the most turbulent and changing of times in the history of Great Britain. Church and state and the very existence of civil liberties were rocked to the core. And when the issues of the day had to be settled by three different civil wars, stretching from 1642 to 1651, when England, Scotland, and Ireland was thrust into 10 years of horrible, horrible civil war. Thus, as a Lord Protector for at least 5 years, Oliver Cromwell was forced to take desperate measures for desperate times. I think you'd have to agree that George Bush has been forced to take desperate measures for desperate times since 9/11. I don't think that he wanted to be a president running a global war against terrorism. But out of necessity, he has been forced to do many things that he even himself would have thought unthinkable prior to those airplanes crashing into the towers in New York City. Winston Churchill, the man who crossed the Parliament floor twice from one party to the other and then back again to the other party, was called upon to form a coalition government. And all he promised the British people was blood, sweat, and tears. Because desperate times meant desperate measures when Hitler was seeking to establish his Third Reich and would take Europe down with it. Recently, UN sanctions against North Korea has meant food shipments to children and hungry people in North Korea have been banned and stopped. And the strong nations of the world have voted that those food shipments should be banned, all because of a nuclear threat by that country's leader. Desperate times require desperate measures. Closer to home here in Canada, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, in 1970, did the unthinkable when he called the army out in the streets of Montreal to settle the threat of the FLQ, who already had kidnapped a few political leaders and were threatening to do greater harm in this country. And even in this country, known for its mild form of government, and what some would even consider, certainly under Elliott Trudeau, the socialist agenda, desperate measures were required. It is in the light of such things that we must consider Oliver Cromwell and the events surrounding his charge in England against the treachery of Charles I. Charles I was guilty of seeking to destroy the English-British nation. He was guilty of hiring foreign nations, foreign armies, mercenaries, against his very own people. He was, of course, of the Stuart line. Now, in your bulletin, and I have put in a little diagram here that may help, to understand who the Stuarts were is all important in English history. And in this little diagram, you will see how James the Sixth became James the First of England. The problem was the want of a marriage and the want of a baby. When Elizabeth the First died, she died single, unmarried, and without a child. There was no heir to the throne. And so, James the Sixth of Scotland was considered the rightful title to the throne. And he was invited to become king in England. And so commenced that most grievous of all reigns in the history of England, the reign of the Stuarts. It was James the First who tried to change the Puritan, evangelical, Protestant, Bible-minded people of England and Scotland forcing prelacy, really Romanism in disguise. The people revolted, and what he didn't accomplish, his son Charles I, he attempted by persecution. He even abolished the Parliament from 1629 to 1640. Charles I, who couldn't get along with the Parliament, he shut them down. He appealed to that divine right of kings and said, "I am in complete authority," and proceeded with his own agenda. The Parliament later was restored in 1640, and Oliver Cromwell was an MP for Cambridge and was returned to Parliament at that time. And the Parliament sought to negotiate with the King that he would relinquish some of his powers. The Parliament would have say in some of the political affairs of the country, but all relations broke down. And in 1642, the country was plunged into civil war. The sword had to decide the outcome of the nation and of those issues. It was then that Oliver Cromwell was called upon to serve in the military forces. And eventually, Charles I was defeated, arrested, and beheaded. England again was without a king, without an heir to the throne, except for Charles II, who had been banished to France. And so they looked to Oliver Cromwell. Oliver Cromwell was asked by Parliament to take the role of king. He refused it. But understanding the deep traditions of English law and English monarchical views, he accepted the role of Lord Protector. And for 5 years, 1653 to 58, until he died, he was the man of supreme power in England. The model of government that he accepted is very akin to what was later adopted in the United States, where you have an executive with personal limited powers, but all final powers in Parliament. And that is how he ruled the country for those 5 years. Now, what we have to consider here tonight is one of three options. Either Oliver Cromwell was an impostor, an opportunist, or that he was a man raised up by God in a very needy period of history. And as in Puritan England, the only way of knowing is by their fruits. And that's the test that we want to apply tonight. Look at Oliver Cromwell, number one, as the godly saint. Then Oliver Cromwell, the godly soldier. And then thirdly, Oliver Cromwell, the godly statesman. And we will learn that God was with him, just as we read of David at the end of Saul's reign, that everything David did was wise, and the people recognized, even before Saul's reign was over, the people recognized God is with David. So let's start with God was with him as a saint. Now, he'd been born in 1599. It was not until he was somewhere around 28 years of age that he had anything like a spiritual conversion. In fact, in the period before that, he fell into what they called in those days melancholy, what we would call depression. A very dark, gloomy period. He attended a noted physician in London. in fact, was the royal family's physician, and the report was that he suffered extreme melancholy, which means extreme depression. He went through great turmoil of mind and heart. Now, we don't know whether that was spiritual conviction or whether it was a more physical problem that he had. But it was out of that dark, dark period that the Lord in great grace shone the light into Oliver Cromwell's heart. And I want to read to you an extract of a little note that he wrote to a cousin, in which he speaks of the light that shone into his own heart at that time. He said, "Honour my God by declaring what he hath done for my soul. Truly no poor creature hath more cause to put forth himself in the cause of his God than I. The Lord accept me in his Son, and give me to walk in the light, and give us to walk in the light as he is the light. He it is that enlighteneth our blackness, our darkness. I dare not say he hideth his face from me. He giveth me to see light in his light. One beam in a dark place hath exceeding much refreshment in it. Blessed be his name for shining upon so dark a heart as mine. You know what manner of life hath been. Oh, I have lived in and loved darkness and hated the light. I was a chief, the chief of sinners. This is true, I hated godliness. Yet God had mercy on me. Oh, the riches of his mercy, praise him for me, that he hath begun a good work, that he should perfect it to the day of Christ." And so that note, that written testimony, gives us great hope that here is a man that had a true spiritual conversion to faith in the Lord Jesus. He called himself the chief of sinners. So it's obvious he went through a time of conviction of sin, of feeling the weight and the guilt of his own sins. But the Lord in mercy brought him into the light and the discovery of God's grace. Now, this written testimony and his whole manner of interest in promoting godliness through his life shows a consistent walk with the Lord in the light of his word. And even in his death, if you move from one extreme of his life to the other, from the day of his conversion to the hour of his death, you will find that he never let go that hope which he had in the Lord. There's a story that Oliver on one occasion turned anxiously to a minister. This is a short period before he died. And he asked, "Tell me, is it possible to fall from grace?" The minister replied soothingly that no, it was not possible. At this, the protector relaxed once more and sighed, "I am safe, for I know I was once in grace." And a biographer says that Cromwell in the last 24 hours showed no uncertainties and was heard to say, "Faith in the covenant is my only support. Yet if I believe not, he remains faithful." His text on which he rested was, "Herein is love, not that we love God, but that he loved us." Oliver Cromwell died on September the 3rd, 1658, a notable day, I should add, because it was on September 3rd, on a number of different years, that he fought and won several outstanding battles. That was an auspicious date in Oliver Cromwell's life. But here was the greatest battle of all, of entering into the glory with a certain hope in the gospel of Christ. And we have every reason to believe, if you're a Christian tonight, that you will see him one day in heaven. And indeed, that is the greatest of victories. That's the greatest of victories. To know that he was a saint and that he's with the Lord, and we can have that confidence. I trust tonight you have that confidence that you're saved and that you're going to be with the Lord and that the Lord is faithful and is your Savior. We move now to Cromwell. God was with him as a soldier, a godly soldier. Now the proof that God was with him has to be in the victories that God gave him. And in Puritan theology, as they read the book of Providence as well as the book of Scripture, because they believed that God was governing in all the affairs of men, in raising men up and bringing men down, God is always, his hand is at work. And the way they assess and judge if a man has God with him is in the successes or the victories that God gives him. Now, I think you have to be very careful with that theology. If you applied it to Job in the short term, you would get your view skewed. And there are periods in the Christian life when everything seems to go wrong, and men might say that God has left you, and he has not. Nevertheless, there was a lot at stake here. Charles I was the traitor. Oliver Cromwell, he was only one of the generals in the parliamentary army. But the parliament insisted that God's blessing was with them. They marched into their battles singing psalms, trusting in God's help. Now the first great battle where Cromwell's leadership, not only as a leader of men, but a leader in war, was at a battle of Marston Moor. And it was near the city of York when 40,000 men faced each other. Approximately 20,000 on each side. 20,000 were the king's men. 20,000 were with the parliamentary troops. In this moor, it was a veritable marsh. The king's men had the higher ground. They had the cover of a wood, a slight military tactical advantage. The parliamentary troops moved into position across a marsh with no advantage. In the afternoon, they waited for orders to commence battle. There is a report that in that afternoon, Oliver Cromwell left the scene of battle. He went into a local town and entered into a home, and a little girl gave witness that she saw him in a private room. She spied through a little opening in the door, and she saw and heard Oliver Cromwell on his knees praying that God would give the victory on that all-important battle, one of the first major battles of the Civil Wars. That evening, although daylight was growing shorter, and although the king's man, Prince Rupert, was at supper, totally unsuspecting any advance of the enemy, his enemy at that time, Cromwell's generals decided to advance at around 7 p.m., in lashing rain. In 2.5 hours, the battle was over, even before darkness. It was July, even before darkness fell, and the king's forces were routed. 4,000 of the king's men were left in the field for burial. 300 of the Parliament's men, Cromwell's side, were killed in battle, although there were many wounded. It was in that battle that Prince Rupert, who was really a German mercenary soldier, gave Cromwell and his men the nickname Ironsides. Now, Oliver Cromwell ascribed the victory of that day to God. And he wrote these words, "Truly England and the Church of God have had a great favor from the Lord in this great victory given to us. It had all the evidence of an absolute victory obtained by the Lord's blessing upon the godly party principally." Oliver Cromwell. It also has to be said that Oliver Cromwell, as a general leading his own new model army, because he did remodel the army and insisted that every one of his men that served under him would not swear, would not drink or be found drunken, and that they would pay their 12 pence in the shilling. That's the old English money, 12 pence in the shilling. They would be honest men. He believed that if he was going to win battles, he needed men who feared God. He didn't care if they were Baptists or nonconformists or Presbyterians. Well, he didn't particularly like Presbyterians, by the way. Oliver Cromwell was a great independent and was till the day he died. But when you're in war, you don't mind fighting alongside a Presbyterian, as long as they feared God. And the Lord honored that army, and in their 10 years of civil strife under the leadership of Cromwell, never lost one major battle. Now, there are other skirmishes and clean-up operations where they got into trouble and they had to retreat and do all kinds of things. But in their major battles, never lost a major battle. We have to say that in the affairs of men, God was with him as a soldier. Now, a great soldier has to be a leader of men. He has to be a man who loves his men, and they must love him. And I want to read you a little note that he sent to a father whose son was killed in one of the battles, indeed in that first battle at Marston Moor. His leg had been blown off in that battle, and he died. And he sent this note to his father. "It broke his leg. We were necessitated to cut it off. Whereof he died. Sir, you know my trials this way." And he was referring there to the death of his own two sons, one through sickness, one also in war. "But the Lord supported me with this, that the Lord took him into the happiness we all pant after and live for. There is your precious child full of glory, to know sin nor sorrow any more. He was a gallant young man, exceeding gracious. God gave you his comfort. Before his death he was so full of comfort that to Frank Russell and myself he could not express it. It was so great above his pain." And those were days when surgeons in the battlefield were rare. Remedies for pain were rare, and certainly antibiotics were unknown. "Truly he was exceedingly beloved in the army, of all that knew him. But few knew him, for he was a precious young man, first for God. You have cause to bless the Lord. He is a glorious saint in heaven, wherein you ought exceedingly to rejoice. Let this drink up your sorrow, seeing these are not feigned, or they are not pretended words to comfort you. But the thing is so real and undoubted a truth, you may do all things by the strength of Christ." And I think here you have the evidence that Cromwell was not a man merely of harsh, determined, set upon victory only, but a man who was as a father to men, and who understood a father's heart at the tragic news of the loss of his son. For 10 years, Oliver Cromwell crisscrossed England Ireland, Scotland, until the issues of the land were settled. And we have to say, God was with him. I want to move on now to God with him as a statesman. It's well said, give a man a little power and you'll really discover what he is. We all fear that when someone who rises the ladder of fame and power, what's he going to do with the power when he gets there? Well, Cromwell, as a member of Parliament, signed the death warrant of Charles I. Now, this was never, ever known of before, certainly not in England. And the idea of trying a king was a novel one. Previous monarchs had been deposed, they had been reined in, but whoever had thought of signing the death warrant to execute a king? Oliver Cromwell signed that death warrant. But let it be known that it was not his decision alone. It was the decision of Parliament when 135 commissioners, all parliamentarians, met on that decision. And there were 59 other names to that death warrant of Charles I. For a number of years, Charles' death, Cromwell continued to serve his country as a member of Parliament and as the head of the army. When he returned from the Battle of Worcester in 1651, which was the last major battle, which you probably should know was the saddest event of all, when Charles II, Charles I's son, mustered an army amongst the Scottish Presbyterians to fight against the English to regain the throne. And Oliver Cromwell, this is the awful, awful, horrible story of civil wars. Friend fighting friend. But Oliver Cromwell routed that army, chased Charles II till he was heard of no more, and returned to London with the applause of every Englishman who understood the threat of the times. That battle, by the way, the final battle, was September the 3rd, 1651. Another auspicious date. He returned to London, in reality, the supreme leader in all things politics at that time. But he continued to serve in the Parliament for two more years, hoping and attempting to organize, direct the government and the affairs of the nation by a humble petition. Some have said if he had been a Napoleon, he would have grasped the throne at that opportunity. But he had no aspirations to take the throne of England. Now, he later became very upset with Parliament. And this is where things get really interesting. Parliament, we're about to pass an act to extend the length of their tenure. They were already 13 years in office, called the Long Parliament, and they were about to enact legislation that they would be a government in perpetuity, endlessly, and that they would bring in and vote from the inside whom they wished. Oliver Cromwell saw the corruption of this. He saw the politics and the power-seeking of this. And so, moments before the bill was signed, he stood up and he called their corruption and he called in his army and he shut down the illegal, corrupt attempts of the Parliament at that very time. What did he do? He organized another parliament on proper parliamentary terms. He refused to be made king, and instead he opted for the position of Lord Protector for life. He also refused that power of office would pass to his heirs by right, although it is true that on his deathbed that he requested that his son Richard would serve after him. But he rejected legislation that all in his office would be followed automatically by family. He also served by a constitution. It was called the Institution of Government. And however one may interpret the political turmoil between Cromwell and the Parliament during the short years of his office, the one thing that every historian has to agree upon, England prospered. Peace, normality, prosperity, science, education, law, prospered. His foreign policy became the envy of the world. He promoted the navy. He signed peace treaties with Portugal, Holland, France. He settled the affairs of Scotland, bringing them into the Commonwealth, which was a master arrangement in political terms. And the people prospered during his times. Now, as to his campaigns in Ireland, we have to say a word. The backdrop of this, please remember that in England, it was illegal to practice Roman Catholic worship. It was illegal for a priest to perform worship on English soil. Many English Roman Catholics lost their estates and lands. Toleration was given to Protestants only. Therefore, in Ireland, things were difficult. It is one of the saddest, darkest stains on English history. Many thinking of Cromwell are always told the story of what happened at a place called Drogheda, just north of Dublin, where 3,000 were put to death in one day. Please remember that it was the English Parliament that who enacted the No Quarter Bill, Take No Prisoners. That was not Oliver Cromwell's command, single command. Please remember that at Drogheda, many of those 3,000 were actually Englishmen who had gone to Ireland after the Civil Wars, had stirred up revolt, had sought to support Charles I or Charles II to lead another army against the Commonwealth. Nevertheless, however you read the history of the English treatment of the Irish, there is very little to be proud of. But also remember that in 1641, ever before Cromwell was a soldier, in the rebellion of 1641, the blood of 12,000 Protestants flowed in a single uprising. It was not a happy arrangement. And remember that the Confederation of Catholicism in Ireland was funded by the Pope of Rome, by his emissary, a man called Rossini, who arrived in Ireland with money, with advice and counsel, how to oppose the English. And they stirred up the Irish to mad proportions, when otherwise there may have been terms of peace. There are three lessons that I would draw at the close tonight on Cromwell's life. First of all, that the truth and gospel liberty has to be fought for with great determination. That's one thing we learn from Oliver Cromwell. Such is the depravity of this world and the hostility against truth that no man can afford to sit down and let things go by. The truth is to be defended, to be fought for, and to be stood up for. And we need in the church today, we need in Christian minds and in Christian institutions, the will, the determination of an Oliver Cromwell to stand for principle and truth against all error. Secondly, I would say this, we learn that a spirit of toleration does not mean compromise with error, but a willingness to let the Lord work in His own time. There are things in this world we can't put right. There are things that we would like to see change today. But we have to leave many things in the Lord's hand. There is no perfect system of government. There are no perfect political leaders. But where there is loyalty, honesty, and unity, much can be achieved. And certainly that's what Oliver Cromwell teaches us over and over again. A third lesson, and by no means least, although it's the last tonight, a great lesson we take from this is that righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And whether it is your home, your church, or your country, we must have God's blessing through purity. Purity. Where sin abounds, where impurity and immorality is tolerated, God will not be with us. And that adage that England's greatness is the Bible is true. England's greatness was the Bible. But it has to be the Bible applied. It has to be the Bible lived out. It has to be the Bible searched and obeyed. And I can assure you tonight that of all English men, statesmen, all examples to the Christian church today, Oliver Cromwell believed in living out what he discovered in God's book. Do you tonight? Or are you a victim to the tolerate everything, accept everything, and God will bless no matter what? God blesses righteousness. And that was one of the key words in Oliver Cromwell's vocabulary. The righteous and righteousness. Godliness is required. And that is why we're thankful to discover Cromwell, the godly saint, the godly soldier, and the godly statesman. And while he evidently had many, many enemies, the Lord was with him. And even though his body was dug up and his head was hung on Westminster railings in the Tyburn, the jail area of the city, he's with the Lord. Where will your soul be? Righteousness exalteth the nation. That must be your insistence. And as we learned this morning, it is to have the righteousness of Christ, firstly, that makes us to campaign for righteousness all around us. I pray tonight that you have that personal faith, that saving faith in the righteousness of Christ, and that His grace is yours tonight. And so on this Reformation Sunday, we've had a little look into the life of one of the most renowned, some people would say infamous figures. We will call him a renowned figure in British history. A man certainly not to be ashamed of. I think we would take a whole church of Oliver Cromwell's tonight. We would take a whole host of such men in the Church of Christ today. I'm not sure if we could persuade that Oliver Cromwell to join a free Presbyterian church. We might need a long discussion on church polity to persuade him on that. However, in all manner of godliness, we would agree with him. Where are you at tonight in your Christian life? Someone here tonight, you're not even saved. All of this history is, well, it's just history. But you see, to the Christian, it's exciting. It's what God can do with a man that is sold out to the truth, who is not self-serving or men-serving, but a servant of God. And if you dedicate your life to the cause of the living God, He can use you. He will be with you in wherever you're doing, whatever service you're following. You will have His favor and blessing. And that's what we want for every believer here tonight, for our young people, for those that are launching out into life. Your number one commission is to be a servant of righteousness and truth and godliness. There will be many times you will have to take your stand. Many times, I trust that you will never need a sword or any such weapon. But you will have to be principled and strong in your faith and determined that you will do that which will bring God's blessing. These are the lessons that come to us. And oh, that the Lord may use us.